Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 15th of October 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live tonight at radioalbion.com because this is one of our live shows that we do. We also have a live show on Thursdays with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. Tonight's show is going to be looking at Moses and our moon as the 16th part in our little series here on Egypt. And before we get into that, I will introduce my co-host, the Patriarch. Patriarch, how are you doing? What's life like for you?
I am very well, thanks. Life's all right now. Autumn season,
well.
So it's all right.
That's good. That is good to hear. I think we're doing quite well with this series so far, 16 episodes, and I'm just finding more and more things for us to discuss. And last week we had a little bit of confusion at the beginning there, so we'll be covering that tonight before we get into the main meat of things. The first bit I wanted to add was about the Black Lives Matter riots. Last week, I said the cost of the Black Lives Matter riots last year was $5 billion to the insurance companies. And it was actually $2 billion to the insurance companies. But as we learned after the Rodney King riots, which cost $1 billion in insurance, this figure was not including a further $3.8 billion loss in sales decline after the riots. So it would have actually been but around about $4 billion after the Rodney King riots. So, and that's with $1 billion in insurance. So if it was $2 billion after the St. Floyd riots, then it's definitely going to be more than $5 billion, in excess of $5 billion, probably more like $6 billion, which is actually more than the total gross domestic product produced by the entirety of Somalia in 2020. Just to give some comparison to the amount of damage that was actually done during those riots. I don't know if you want to comment on that before I move on to the next bit, Patriarch.
No, I'm happy with that.
Yeah, I just thought I'd add that little bit there about the gross domestic product. I mean, you just think about that much damage. It would take Somalia a year to pay back all that damage that was done in the name of George Floyd. Well, the second little bit that we wanted to talk about was the IPUWA translations. Now, there are many translations online, but the one that I used came from Pritchard's Ancient and Near Eastern Texts Relating to the Old Testament, which was published in 1950. IPUWA's papyrus has always been associated with the plagues of Exodus due to some similarities, but this early translation clearly identifies foreigners as being the cause of the calamities, rather than them being supernatural. It also could only have taken place before the plagues of the Exodus, as the foreigners were still in the Egyptian Delta at the time that this papyrus was written. The more recent translations available online appear to have had the language in them politically corrected. For instance, instead of saying foreigners have become people everywhere, they say the tribes of the desert have become Egyptians. Where it says let us banish many from us, they change it to let us suppress the powerful among us. Barbarians from outside have come to Egypt, there really are no people anywhere, is changed to indeed men arrive, and indeed there are no Egyptians anywhere. The comment about foreigners taking all the wealth is made out to be a good thing. Here is the original. The heart of the king must indeed be glad when truth comes to him, but really every foreign country comes. Such is our water, such is our welfare, what can we do about it? Going to ruin. And that has been changed to happy indeed is the heart of the king when truth comes to him and every foreign land comes. That is our fate and that is our happiness. One part that does portray the truth is here where it says those who were Egyptians have become foreigners and are thrust aside. It is clear that none of this was the result of a slave population, which is what the Israelites were at the time of the plagues. And we learned in the first episode dealing with the Hyksos that their people were first brought into the country and treated as friendly merchants before they suddenly rose up and took over. And the new translations also have indeed as the rhetorical device at the beginning of each line instead of why really. They are essentially the same piece of text by the same priest. There is only one of them, and the last page is unfortunately missing in all the translations. And it may be that people are associating the Hyksos with the Jews because they know today's Jews are a different ethnicity to the ancient Egyptians. But as we have learned, the difference between the actual Israelites and the Egyptians would be analogous to the small difference between the Danes and the English, whereas the Hyksos were identified as being Asiatic, not being of a racial type the Egyptians were used to, which is why the Hyksos were able to take advantage of the Egyptians' naivety to occupy and take over the fertile delta land that opened onto the Mediterranean. So it's really good that you pointed that out last week, because we could discover that it's been politically corrected to try and give this other alternative explanation for it, rather than seeing that this was caused by these foreigners that the Egyptians invited into the country, and then they rose up and they took over, and that's what caused all these problems. But a lot of people today will try and portray it as, oh, this is talking about the plagues of the Exodus, and that.
Yeah.
That can't have happened, really, because of the situation that was there, because the foreigners were living in the Delta, and we know that that wasn't the case when we get to the Exodus. So do you want to comment on that?
Well, just to reiterate on the confusion, obviously we had the texts, and then upon my research, was going through Google, which was a big mistake. And then, on the surface, they make a good case, cherry picking a lot of the biblical narrative, and then matching the verses with the newly retranslated, more politically correct versions, and it's almost so contrived that it kind of makes you think twice. But when you get to the root of it, it doesn't hold up, and like you say, when you analyze it in context with the history, it's clearly not referring to the Exodus story. So I just wonder what the reasoning might be for, politicizing, such ancient documents and kind of, watering down the language. You think it's literally to reflect positively on a certain group of people?
Well, I think it's really just to politically correct the language. They don't want foreigners to be called barbarians. They don't want people to know that the Egyptians didn't consider other peoples to even be people at all. They didn't consider these other peoples to be human beings. I mean, and that's the same in the Old Testament. They didn't consider the other peoples to actually be human beings. They referred to them as animals in parts of it. And I don't think today's historians, the modern historians, want people to know that. Political correctness is rife in everything. I mean, that book, The Ancient and Near Eastern Text, that was written in 1950. And if you compare history books that were written 50, 60, 70 years ago to the ones that are written today, they're so much more patriotic back then. And they were quite clear that this is being written by a specific ethnicity, and it's being told from that specific ethnicity's point of view. Whereas today, they try to make it applicable to everyone, and there's no real accuracy to it. So I think that played into it. And also, because they want to try and say that the Jews were the Hyksos and the Israelites were the Hyksos, and they want to try and portray it as if the Israelites were Hyksos, because we know that the Hyksos were very similar to today's Jews. So I think that plays into it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, but when comparing it to other history texts, such as when we started out looking at ancient Sumer and like the black-headed peoples, and that didn't seem to be watered down as such. Maybe this is more of a hot topic, so they thought that it was more in the best interests to refine it.
Well, that was from the 1950s, maybe even earlier than that, that those sources were taken from. They may have been changed today. There was a lot of interest in Sumer in the 50s and the 60s.
Okay.
And the quotes which I had were taken from books from around that time and even earlier,
right.
I think.
So all along we've been getting the Sven unadulterated raw version.
The originals, yeah. Well, you've always got to go back as far as you can. I mean, also yeah. with original source documents as well. Like when I was doing research on Edward I, we went right back to documents that were written at the time while he was alive. And they tell a very different story to the mainstream biography that is told of Edward I today. And yet the ones that we went back to were written when he was still alive. So they're going to be the most accurate. You're not going to be able to get away with lying about somebody when they're still alive. So primary source yeah. documents are very important. And just something else, when we get into this, a lot of the stuff we're talking about, like when we were referring to Joseph and the Hyksos, and the mainstream narrative is that Joseph was staying with the Hyksos, they were his people, and we were saying, no, he was staying with the Egyptians, and he helped to get the land back for the Egyptians from the Hyksos. And right the way through this, we'll see that the mainstream narrative is quite close, but what we're talking about is slightly different to it, we're defining the ethnicities that are involved, and we're giving the reasons why we came to that conclusion. And I think our conclusion is correct, and the mainstream one is not correct. And because the mainstream one is not correct, that's one of the reasons why a lot of people look at Christianity or they look at the Bible and they say, oh, that's all been proved that it's not true. And that's because people are looking in the wrong places for it. They're looking at history in the wrong way. And we'll see more of that. We'll see more of that tonight as well.
Mm-hmm.
After the Egyptians finally managed to rid the country of the Hyksos and the Nubians, because you had also had their problems with the Nubians down there in the south, and it was actually Amose who managed to get rid of them both, and we're suggesting that was the Egyptian king that was living in Thebes that Joseph helped out. After he managed to rid the country of the Hyksos and the Nubians, the new kingdom pharaohs established a period of unprecedented prosperity by securing their borders and strengthening diplomatic ties with their neighbours, including the Mitanni Empire, the Assyria, and Canaan. Military campaigns waged under Thutmose I and his grandson Thutmose III extended the influence of the pharaohs to the largest empire Egypt had ever seen. Beginning with Merneptah, the rulers of Egypt adopted the title of pharaoh. And remember, in Canaan, you had all different ethnicities. I mean, the Hyksos was just one particular type that was in Egypt, because we also had Joseph's family were originally in Canaan as well. And between their reigns, Hatshepsut, a queen who established herself as a pharaoh, launched many building projects, including the restoration of the temples that had been damaged by the Hyksos, and she sent trading expeditions to Punt and the Sinai. It was this queen that likely adopted Moses, and Clifton Emmerheiser has done a lot of work on this subject. Moses had to have taken his name from one of the pharaohs that were related to her, and he dates this as happening around the 1300s BC, rather than the 1500 BC of the establishment historians. Moses was brought up by her as a court favourite, but then fled from Egypt upon the accession of her enemy, Thutmose III, to the throne. And it's quite interesting, this Hatshepsut, because she was pictured with a beard. And Clifton Emmerheiser believes that the pictures that we have of her with a small girl, he thinks that was actually Moses, and it's not beyond the realms of possibility that she disguised him as a little girl when he was small in order to get that passed to pass him off as a female because the Egyptians were on the lookout for these Hebrew males. I mean, I don't know how credible that is, but that is his idea. But it's certainly credible that Hatshepsut was the Egyptian princess that actually rescued Moses, and that's talked about a fair bit in the mainstream.
Yeah, that's why it's logical that she could do that if they were looking for specifically, you know, Hebrew boys, Hebrew.
Yeah,
but why would she? Why would she be represented as wearing a beard? A manly trait,
so that she could be seen as the pharaoh, because she was a co-regent, and because they would only allow male rulers, it was a patriarchy, so she was pictured with a beard as a way to sort of excuse the fact that she wasn't a male.
We were talking about Moses being potentially represented as a little girl because the Hebrew boys were being targeted.
And that would have disguised him. But the other issue is why she would have wanted to actually rescue a Hebrew boy. And there is a theory that it may have been because that she herself was actually Hebrew.
Yeah.
Which we'll get into a bit more later on. But also it's interesting that she rebuilt all these temples because the temples that she was rebuilding were the temples to Amun. Again, who is particularly interesting, and we'll get into that again in a bit. But the reason why she was wearing this beard is because she was the co-regent, and she wanted to be seen as being an effective leader, basically, I guess. And she was half sister to Thutmose, and she was co-regent for the first 20 years of his reign, and that would have been when he was too small to actually reign. And though he despised her, she completely dominated him. After her death, he ruled alone for 30 years, becoming the greatest conqueror in Egyptian history. He subdued Ethiopia and ruled all the way to the Euphrates in the first of the great empires in history. He raided Palestine and Syria 17 times, built a navy, and accumulated great wealth. He was engaged in vast building enterprises, and he recorded his achievements in details on walls and monuments. His tomb is at Thebes, and his mummy is at Cairo. Since the Pharaoh of the Exodus was killed, either the Bible reference was to another member of the family, perhaps Thutmose II, or it was a different mummy that was found. Since the death of the Pharaoh and the plagues would have been seen as a disgrace to Egypt, it may be that they hid all reference to these events. And as we will see shortly, the Egyptians did in fact do this with all references to Thutmose's son, Amenhotep IV. And that was for a different reason. But they did hide all reference to this particular Pharaoh. So it's not out of the realms of possibility that they would have done the same thing about these plagues due to Exodus. And Clifton Emmerheiser writes that if Thutmose was the oppressor of Israel, then the famous Queen Hatshepsut may well have been the Pharaoh's daughter who rescued and brought up Moses. And he gets a confirmation from Halley's Bible Handbook. I don't know if you want to add anything.
I just wonder if at this point Egypt was under majority white rule.
Yes, it was. It was back under white rule again, but there had been some intermixing with the bloodline. Her half brother, this Thutmose that she was dominating, that she didn't want to rule, mm-hmm. He was mixed race basically.
Yeah.
Whereas she wasn't.
Because I mean, a lot of these the Black Hebrew Israelites, if you know of those. One of the biggest claims that they have is that Moses must have been black because he had to have blended in, you know, but obviously...
that's their logic, isn't it? That's their logic. Oh, they think that Egypt is in Africa. It's on the African continent. Therefore, the Egyptians must have been black. All of them.
Yeah.
There's no nuance to it. Well, Egypt is a part of the African continent, but... the sub-Saharan Negroes were always at sub-Sahara. They were right at the bottom there. They couldn't make their way through the Sahara. And we also had white people there. We had the Carthaginians and the Phoenicians and and the Egyptians. And we know that they were white because we looked at the mummies. So they do have these crazy ideas. But as we've shown through the Joseph story, it was with the original Egyptians at Thebes that Joseph was with, and they described the Hyksos as being Asiatic. And we know that they knew what the different races looked like. I used that picture to illustrate the last podcast. They knew the difference between the races. So they knew that these Asiatics were different from them, and that was the Hyksos. And that's the group that the Jews associate themselves with, and they were part Canaanite, basically, the Hyksos people. So we know that Joseph was, so we know that the people that Joseph was staying with were white, and we know that Joseph was white. The Bible tells us that he was white, and we can see the ancestry of all the nations that came from Noah. As we went into that, when we talked about that, the descendants from Ham and Mizraim, they were white, and the descendants from Shem, they were white. So Moses would have been white, but the, sure. this Pharaoh here, this Tutmosi the second, he had a foreign mother, and we'll actually see in a bit. It was around about this time that they started taking in queens from other nations. So they would take Hittite women as queens, and we'll get into that in a bit. But just to do with the dating of the Exodus, we've got a quote here from the Bible and Archaeology by J.A. Thompson. And he says, when did the Exodus take place? It has been widely held that the Exodus took place about 1440 BC. One reason for this has been found in 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1, where we have the statement, and it came to pass in the 480th year after the children of Israel were come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, that he began to build the house of the Lord. And we have good reason to believe that Solomon began to reign about the middle of the 10th century BC, that is, about 950 BC. It would follow from this that the Exodus took place around 1430 BC, in the time of the 18th dynasty, which ruled Egypt from 1570 to 1310 BC. And that's the time that we are talking about now. So now we're actually getting to a time that we can pretty much narrow it down to the actual year. Yeah. Up until now, we've had to be, you know, we've had to use estimates, basically.
Yeah, just to note, the Exodus happened. Not all of the Hebrews would have migrated with the Exodus, would they? Because at the time, the Hebrews were kind of overflowing within Egypt. That much so that they started to spill over abroad, and I think that was one of the reasons for their enslavement in the first place, wasn't it?
It might have been. We do know that they went abroad. I mean, there was Pharez and Zerah, which were the two sons of Judah, and the firstborn was actually Zerah, and he put his hand out first, and they tied a red cord around it. So he was actually the firstborn, and we know that they were in Egypt, and we know that they each one of them formed their own tribes, and yet when they do a head count, they only have the tribe of Pharez there. So we know that Zerah left at some time. When Moses leaves Egypt with the Israelites, they do a head count, and Zerah is not there. He had already left Egypt at some earlier point, and then we can trace him and his descendants. One of the famous ones was Calcol and Dada, and they were the legendary founders of Troy, and then from Troy you can get to the Roman Empire through King Latinus and also Brutus and Britain, and they all go back to Calcol and Dada. And there's a mention somewhere in the Old Testament where it actually talks about Calcol and Dada, talking about one of the Hebrew kings in the Promised Land, and they are comparing him to the wisdom or the strength of Calcol and Dada. So they knew they were outside of the area that they were in, and that would have had to happen because you had two kingly lines there. You couldn't have, you know, two kings. They were twins, so what, you know, you were going to have a struggle over who was going to rule. So one of them had to leave, and it was Zerah that actually left, and he was really the firstborn. But he seems to have started all the kingly lines in Europe, basically, go back to Zerah. And then you have the kingly line in Israel and Judah, which was started by Pharez. And then that line ends up getting broken at the time of the dispersion in about the 6th or 7th century BC. And Jeremiah, the prophet Jeremiah, he takes one of the daughters of the last king of Jerusalem, and he takes the daughter into Egypt, and then from Egypt she supposedly made her way to Ireland and then to Scotland, and her name was Scotta, and then ended up intermarrying again with the line from Zerah that was actually in Britain at the time. And then we get the British royal family, which is supposed to come from both Pharez and Zara. And also, this is where the coronation stone comes from, that's under the chair that all our monarchs get coronated on. That's called the Stone of Scone. And that was taken by Edward I from Scotland back down to London. But before that, it made its way over from Ireland to Scotland. And before that, it was supposed to be the stone that all the kings of Judah were coronated on. So the, all this history ties in. But yeah, they supposedly left beforehand, and the proof for that is in this census that was taken as soon as Moses had left. And we can see that Zara and all his people had actually left before Moses did.
Yeah, I mean, I think they probably started to trickle out over different periods. I think it's in, I did some document research on before, and it was one scripture in particular, Exodus 1:12, that if you look at the Strong's, where it says they multiplied and grew, the root word behind it is to kind of spread abroad, to breach away and break away. So I'm pretty convinced that, you know, there were some dispersions prior to the Exodus as well.
Definitely. And Zara would have taken other groups with him. It wouldn't have just all been Zarahites. You know, there would have been Danites and Gadites and Zebulonites and all the rest of them. I'm sure he would have taken quite a few with him, because he was the rightful elder son, basically. He was the one that really had the birthright. And yet he left. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, certain that there's lots of them that left. But when you're looking for the proof of that, it's the census that you have to look at. Because we know Zara and his people went into Egypt because they're listed. But then when Moses takes the census after coming out from Egypt, we know that they're not there. So we have to look elsewhere for them.
Mm-hmm.
Now we'll find out a little bit about this Hatshepsut. And this comes from Clifton Emmerhiser's work. Hatshepsut was the last of a line having purely royal blood in the house of Pharaoh. We can also be pretty sure that she was of the line of Shem. If you remember, the Bible narrative relates that the Egyptian Pharaoh gave Joseph his wife. We also know that Joseph's wife was of the house of Shem, for her father was a priest of On, and On was called Beth Shemesh, meaning the house of Shem. And unless the Pharaoh that gave Joseph his wife was also of the house of Shem, he would not have had the authority to do this. And we also know that the Pharaoh asked for the blessing from Jacob's father, which also implies that he was from the house of Shem. So this Hatshepsut that was descended from him, she had to have been from the line of Shem as well. But this other Pharaoh, this Thutmose III, he came from another parentage. It wasn't really until Thutmose III that the Egyptians brought Hurrian women back to Egypt in any quantity, and the Hurrians were Canaanites. But bad blood had already got into the bloodline of the Egyptian pharaohs, and Clifton goes into a lot of detail showing the proof of this. And Hatshepsut was the last of the royal line from Shem going back to the building of the Great Pyramid, because if we remember, there was people that stayed there after the Great Pyramid. A priest stayed there, and he would have stayed there with his retinue. If this is true, we can see why Hatshepsut, as the daughter of Thutmose I, would take Moses to raise, for she would have known he was of pure Shemitic blood. No doubt she could see in Moses a possible husband for one of her daughters. This is probably what she was doing when she took the throne herself, in order to prevent her half-blood nephew, Thutmose III, a child by a non-royal mother, from taking the throne. It would appear she was simply buying time until this could happen. So that sort of explains the reasoning why she was doing this, and what was going on, and what the ethnicity was, and what the bloodlines were in it. It all ties together. I mean, most people aren't aware of the fact that the city of On was also called Beth Shemesh. It was also called Heliopolis. But people look at it and they think, oh, it's called On, and he was a priest of On, so he must have been a priest of whatever On was, Heliopolis. Oh, he must have been a priest of the sun god. But On was also called Beth Shemesh. So saying he was a priest of On, a priest of Beth Shemesh, meant that he was a priest of the house of Shem. So that it all ties in together. Now, when Thutmose III died in 1425, Egypt had an empire extending from Nia in northwest Syria to the fourth cataract of the Nile in Nubia, cementing loyalties and opening access to critical imports such as bronze and wood. The new kingdom pharaohs began a large-scale building campaign to promote the god Amun, whose growing cult was based in Karnak. They also constructed monuments to glorify their own achievements, both real and imagined. This is when the Karnak Temple was begun, which is the largest Egyptian temple ever built. As well as having a name that is the same as the end of the Christian prayer, Amun did have similarities to the Christian god. He held the position of transcendental self-created creator deity par excellence. He was the champion of the poor or troubled, and he was central to personal piety. His position as king of the gods developed to the point of virtual monotheism, where all the other gods became manifestations of him. With Osiris, Amun-Ra is the most widely recognized of the Egyptian gods, and he is also portrayed as green, providing a link to the green man representation that we find in old British churches. Just like aspects of Yahweh were grafted onto El Elyon of the Canaanites and El of the Sumerians, it may be that Amun was also just the Egyptian version of him. Amun-Ra would also later be identified with Zeus in Greece, and I'm going to put a picture of Amun-Ra in Greece as Zeus with this podcast. But he was also associated with the ram. He was associated with the lamb. He was pictured with horns. We also find Moses is also pictured with horns. And this is before horns were associated with devilry. And when we look in the book of Revelations, it depicts Jesus as having horns as the Lamb of God. So we have this link there with the lamb, with the shepherd, because he is pictured as this ram. And people would also have to confess their sins before they would actually worship this Amun. And his cult was centered around Thebes. And it was Ahmose, who is the Egyptian king that we're saying that was the good guy to Joseph. That was the Egyptian king that they saved. Once he had got rid of the Hyksos and the Nubians, he was the one that set up this building campaign and said, everybody's going to worship this Amun. He's the god that we should be worshiping. And I think that's because this was the Egyptian version of Yahweh, and that was obviously the same god that Joseph was worshipping, and that's why there's this link there. And there's also another link with to put this Ahmose with Joseph, and that is the fact that he took 10% tax from all the Egyptians to pay to the priests. And the idea of taxing the Egyptians, they hadn't done that before. And we're told in the Bible that it was Joseph that came up with that idea during the famine. And he taxed the people and said, from now on, you need to pay tax to the Pharaoh. And then we find that it was this Ahmose that was the first guy to actually get tax. And he used it to pay the priests so that they could build these temples to this god Amun, who it was monotheism. All the other gods were then seen as being aspects of this Amun or Amen, and I guess it does link in with the end of the Christian prayer as well. Amen. Mm. I think there's too many coincidences for it to be a coincidence, well, basically.
I think Amen in Hebrew means let it be, doesn't it?
Possibly.
I think that's the meaning of it, from what I've learned anyway. It could sound similar, Amen, but I'm pretty sure it means let it be. That's what it's like, an affirmation, let it be. It's being in agreement with something. But yeah, it is really interesting how there are very, there's common strands within these religions. It's almost like there was the initial kind of truth or religion that was kind of passed down when did Moses write the tablets and the Bible was kind of, you know, put together? It would have been after the Exodus, wouldn't it? So before then, they would have had clay tablets, and I'm assuming that would have, you know, they'd have had a lot of history passed down from the Adamic story of creation, And then from there, it would have spawned off, they'd have had offshoots, different kind of beliefs and that come about. And then that's why you see within, different white cultures, different forms of God, but rooted around similar kind of narratives.
Yeah, they're just different witnesses observing the same events. And, you're right, it was the tablets that they carried with them. And then when Moses was writing them down, we can tell from the way that Genesis is written, the first parts of it, that it is actually copied from tablets. And yet we're told today, well, it just must have been these oral stories that he wrote down. And it wasn't. It was because it's in the same format as the tablets were from about 1,000 years before. So we know that it's accurate, and these tablets actually tell you who was the witness to what was going on and at what point in their life they caused this to be written down on the tablet. I mean, we went into that, I think, in the first or the second episode. And I think the Egyptian meaning of the word Amun is hidden or invisible. So, it has a different meaning to the Hebrew meaning, but it's interesting that it's the same word pretty much. Because they didn't use vowels, and we've got it, so it would have just been A-M-N rather than with that U there or the E there. That's us sort of putting that vowel there in between them.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a link somewhat in the sense that it is a substance of it is an element of faith, isn't it? The substance of things hoped for. I mean, in terms of faith, is invisible. I don't know. There might be a sentimental link there.
Yeah, that's very good. The substance of things hoped for. I always looked at it as belief that a promise is going to be kept. I mean, the modern interpretation of faith, isn't it? It's belief in something for which there's no evidence for. No, it's not. It's confidence that a promise is going to be kept, and the promise is what we see all around us. You know, everything mm-hmm. could only have been created out of love. You know, life could only have been created out of love. And yet the world we live in is all twisted and corrupted. So we know that there's got to be something better than that, because we know that there is a God out there that is all love that created this earth. So this cannot be all that there is. And to me, that's the promise, and it's encoded in everything. And that's the faith that you have. Obviously, then you've also got faith in the promises that are given in the Old Testament. Abraham's faith was that from his loins many nations would come, and that faith was tested when Isaac was put on the chopping block. And he knew that Isaac wasn't going to die, even though he was put on there to be sacrificed, because he'd already been promised that from Isaac many nations would come from his loins. So his faith was tested, and that was the faith that Abraham had. It was in God's promise. Yeah, I like that. Faith is the substance of things hoped for.
Yeah, on that point about the promise, what a lot of modern Christians overlook, which I think is very significant in the Book of Acts. It talks about the hope of the promise, especially when he's on trial and he's accused of the Jews of bringing the gospel to all 12 tribes, and that's explicitly mentioned in the Book of Acts, and he states that as the hope of the promise. And our forefathers, they had this hope that all 12 tribes will one day come to worship again, to the Father. But obviously at the time that was impossible because of the dispersions. And then we go and see where Paul went to preach, and it was on the Isles, the coastlands, which was southern Mediterranean, and obviously the Horn of Africa and whatnot. And then that's where a lot of Christianity would have spread. But that was the hope of the promise in prophesied in the Old Testament and fulfilled in the New.
And I think he says, and full that hope, these Jews seek to kill me, or something similar. I think that's the second part of that. Well, moving on from Amun-Ra onto the next pharaoh, which is connected, which is Akhenaten, which is another very famous pharaoh. Around 1350 BC, the stability of the new kingdom was threatened when Amenhotep IV ascended the throne and instituted a series of radical and chaotic reforms. Changing his name to Akhenaten, he touted the previously obscure sun deity Aten as the supreme deity, suppressed the worship of most other deities, and moved his capital to the new city of Akhetaten, which is modern-day Amarna. So we can see he was originally called Amenhotep IV, so he was originally Amen's blessed, or the blessed son of Amen, and he wanted to change that. He hated Amun, basically, and he wanted to institute the worship of this new god, this novel idea that he had had, that everybody should be worshipping this Aten. He was devoted to his new religion, and he created a new artistic style that portrayed him and his family living an idyllic life. But after his death, the cult of the Aten was quickly abandoned and the traditional religious order was restored. Akhenaten was in fact so hated by the people that his face and his name were blotted out from all the records, and his new city was abandoned to the desert. And it wasn't until 150 years ago that we discovered this guy, when we discovered this city. So that to me says that it's not out of the realms of possibility that what happened to the wicked pharaoh and the plagues of Egypt would have just been hidden. Because, you know, they knew if we hide this, then the later generations are not going to know anything about it.
Yeah.
And the priests knew that they could do that. With his monuments dismantled and hidden, his statues destroyed, and his name excluded from the lists of rulers compiled by later pharaohs, traditional religious practice was gradually restored, notably until his close successor Tutankhamun, who changed his name from Tutankhaten early in his reign, and we'll get into him either next week or the week after. When some dozen years later, rulers without clear rights of succession from the 18th dynasty founded a new dynasty, they discredited Akhenaten and his immediate successors and referred to him as the enemy, or that criminal, in archival records. Akhenaten was all but lost to history, until the 19th century discovery of Amarna, the new name for Akhetaten, the new capital city that he built for the worship of the Aten. Akhenaten's rediscovery and Flinders Petrie's early excavations at Amarna sparked great public interest in the pharaoh and his queen Nefertiti. And they also discovered these letters there that we'll get into as well. They give us a really good idea of what was going on, and they confirm what was going on with Joshua as well, because we from Moses we have, I think it's 40 years until Joshua. So this pharaoh here, this Akhenaten, that all would have been happening during the lifetime of Akhenaten, if we are correct, and Hatshepsut was the princess that that looked after Moses. And Akhenaten, most of our listeners have probably seen him. He's got like a really long face and big lips, and he's got a big belly and wide hips, and he looks really, really odd, real strange-looking character, and his wife. And the Freemasons really like him for some reason. They think he's brilliant. Freemasons and Gnostics are big fans of him.
He does look odd, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Very unconventional looking. But yeah, you're right. He looks, what's the word? Well, you don't...
Androgynous?
You know, kind of in between. Androgynous.
Yeah. Yeah.
And very strange.
Androgynous.
But I wonder why he was hated so much. I mean, what was it about him?
Oh, it's because he was, he changed the religion. Everybody was worshipping Amen or Amun. And I think that's because that was Joseph's God, and it reinvigorated the understanding that they should have been worshipping this particular God that they had amongst them, that they knew as Amun. And there had been this punishment of the Egyptians with the plagues, and the actual Egyptians, I think, they understood that was because they'd been mistreating these Hebrews, and they thought, well, we should worship this God because he's very powerful. And I think Akhenaten, his memory was, no, this God's the bad God because he destroyed my ancestor, Thutmose II. And also because this Akhenaten was from this mixed bloodline. So I think that played into it, because he was from different descendants.
Yeah, so maybe he sparked kind of a hatred as a kind of he represented the new world, I guess, the new kind of Egyptian rule, didn't he? It's kind of like similar to how things would be here, really.
Well, I think that I think it's more like atheism what he brought in than monotheism. But see, the mainstream narrative today is, oh, he was the first monotheist. He wasn't. The worship of Amun-Ra, who was very close to had a lot of similarities to Yahweh, that was really one of the first monotheisms, but that wasn't even really the first monotheism. The earliest we go back in history in Egypt, it goes back to there being just one God, and that's just common sense because we all only have one father. You can only have one father. So religion must have started with this understanding that there was only one God. But today, the mainstream narrative is to try and say this was the first monotheism. Moses got his idea from Akhenaten. Moses may have been a priest with Akhenaten, and then he was chased out of Egypt by the people because they didn't like this Akhenaten. And Sigmund Freud is somebody that promotes that idea, and a lot of the books that have been written by Freemasonic authors promote this idea as well. But I think it's false, because I think this worship of the Atum was more like atheism. And also, he was a hypocrite. He was portraying these images of himself playing with his family. He's got his bouncing his children on his knee, lovey-dovey with his wife, and the sunshine all around them, and the ankh there, which is the symbol of life. And then they discovered around Amarna this massive burial pit with all these children in it. And they were sort of 13, 14 years of age, all malnourished, like they're all terrible nourishment, terrible things had happened to their bodies. And they'd obviously been worked really, really hard. And it looks like he used them to actually build this city. So he was portraying himself as being this lovely family type person. But in actual fact, he was a real horrible person that killed thousands of children by just working them into the ground to build this city. And they didn't discover that until, I don't know, it must be in the last 10 years. I can remember seeing the BBC article about it, you know, just discovered this graveyard at Tell El Amarna that's filled up with youngsters, basically.
Really?
And they must have been the slaves. I should have looked it up, actually, for this episode, but I'll look it up for next week and find some details on that. So he wasn't liked by the people. And that could have been one of the reasons for it. But he is very much liked by Freemasons for some reason.
Strange. Yeah.
In year 5 of his reign, Amenhotep IV took decisive steps to establish the Aten as the sole god of Egypt. The pharaoh disbanded the priesthoods of all the other gods and diverted the income from these other cults to support the Aten. To emphasize his complete allegiance to the Aten, the king officially changed his name from Amenhotep IV to Akhenaten. By year 9 of his reign, Akhenaten declared that the Aten was not merely the supreme god, but the only god to be worshipped. He ordered the defacing of Amun's temples throughout Egypt, and in a number of instances, inscriptions of the plural gods were also removed. This emphasized the changes encouraged by the new regime, which included a ban on images, with the exception of a rayed solar disk, in which the rays appear to represent the unseen spirit of Aten, who by then was evidently considered not merely a sun god, but rather a universal deity. All life on Earth was declared to be dependent on the Aten and the visible sunlight. And don't forget, he's just invented this god. This is an invention of this Akhenaten. We've never heard of this Aten before, and he's saying it's the visible sunlight. And again, to me, that sounds like atheism, to say that because the sun doesn't actually create life. You know, put sun on something.
It sustains life.
It sustains it.
It doesn't create it from, it's just another cog in a wheel, isn't it?
Yeah, there's something else that gives us life, an invisible light. That's why I say the black sun is the symbol for Christ. It tells us in the New Testament that Christ is the light that no man has ever seen, the light that no man can see. And that's sort of represented by the halo that you see above the saints' heads. But another way to represent that would be a black sun. So obviously a sun, it's obviously a bright sun, but you can't see it because it's been reversed, and that becomes the symbol of the black sun. So it's a symbol for Christ. Representations of the Aten were always accompanied with a sort of hieroglyphic footnote stating that the representation of the Son as all-encompassing creator was to be taken as just that, a representation of something that by its very nature is something transcending creation that cannot be fully or adequately represented by any one part of that creation. Some debate has focused on the extent to which Akhenaten forced his religious reforms on his people. Certainly as time drew on, he revised the names of the Aten and other religious language to increasingly exclude references to other gods, and at some point also he embarked on the wide-scale erasure of traditional gods' names, especially those of Amun. I mean, he had a real hatred for Amun, basically. It may be that previously the Egyptians had tried to placate Amun after the plagues of Egypt, but Akhenaten thought he knew better and would try to punish him, and this would fit if he was a relative of the wicked pharaoh who mistreated the Israelites. Clifton Emmerheiser has found many links between Amun and Yahweh, and he believes this was another pointer to the line of Shem being in Egypt from the time of the Great Pyramid, and the hatred Akhenaten had for him could be related to Yahweh's wrath that was poured out on the wicked pharaoh who abused the Israelites. The wicked pharaoh could have been any of the complicated pharaonic line around Thutmose III, or it could even have been him, and the body we have identified as Thutmose III may be someone else. And what's really interesting, you know, we never knew any of this until we discovered this Tel El Amarna, and yet it all fits in with the biblical story. Do you want to pick up on any of that?
No, there's one point that I think I know you said about the Freemasons liking Aten, and maybe it's because, is there a link between Freemasonry and the Baphomet, and he's androgynous, and I just wonder if there's that kind of symbol of power and, androgyny.
That's a good point. It may be the androgynous side of it and the union of the two opposites, because Freemasonry is all about that, isn't it? And this Gnostic idea of there not being an absolute evil, not being an absolute good. And then you get the hermaphrodite, and he does have this androgynous look, and his wife was depicted doing male things as well. So
it's almost an inversion on the natural order of things, isn't it?
Yeah.
So maybe that's something that they're attracted to.
And there's also this bit with Sigmund Freud. Akhenaten himself was clearly of mixed race and also inbred, as physically he was extremely weak and with odd bodily proportions, such as having a long face with wide hips. He looks androgynous, and his wife was also depicted doing male activities, such as the smiting of enemies. Gnostics and Masons have a special place for Akhenaten, and many believe that he had a strong influence on Moses. This is based on the work of Sigmund Freud, who tried to pretend that Moses was a priest of Aten who was forced to leave Egypt after Akhenaten's death with his followers. This is based on the erroneous idea that Atenism was the first monotheism, when in reality it was more like the first atheism, as it replaced all previous religious belief with a new belief in no gods and no possible relationship with God. We also heard earlier how the worship of Amun was bordering close to monotheism, and logically the earliest belief in a deity would have been in only one deity, just like we have one father. And also, don't forget, with Amun, they would pray to Amun for forgiveness, and they would confess their sins before Amun, and that's been swapped for this Aten, where they're told that the sun is what gives life to them. So this Aten is really like the opposite of the Black Sun, when you think about it.
For sure. I mean, if you're accustomed to, anyone who's got kind of a spiritual experience with kind of prayer and kind of remission of sin, it's linked to a deep kind of psychological, frame of mind, you know, and to some extent, when you get that kind of remission of sin, you know, you feel a bit more wholesome. And so you can imagine that if that's taken away from the people that are used to kind of gaining a spiritual enlightenment, then and it's been replaced with something that's essentially empty, void, and doesn't really give them any fulfillment, you can imagine their hatred and anger.
Yeah, it was all completely new, and they were told they had to have a new capital as well. You know, when he built this new city, when they were used to having their capital at Thebes, which had been their centre, which they fought against the Hyksos from, and that they defended, and they were told no, they all have to move out in the desert to this new city. And he's quite crazy ideas that he had. I'll just see if I can fit this bit in about Savitri Devi before we finish, because this confirms that it was really atheism, not monotheism. Savitri Devi was fascinated by Akhenaten, which is surprising since she was very against Christianity. And much of the mainstream think Artinism was the first monotheism and a big influence on Christianity. But the reason she likes him is the reason why I say his religion was more like atheism. Here is a quote from her about the Artin. It seems hardly necessary to point out, after what had been said, that philosophically the one and only god Artin is not a transcendent god, similar to the only god of later religions known as monotheistic, but an immanent one in consistence with a religious attitude different from theirs. He is a god from within the universe, not from without, a god who created all existing things out of the millions of vitalities which are in him, not out of nothingness. So she says he was a god from within the universe and not from outside of it. So it was basically self-worship, atheism or pantheism, where you're worshipping within the universe. And God did not create life from nothing either. That would imply creating life from death. God spoke the world into being in the same way that the king speaks law into being, and our promise to repay speaks money into circulation. God created by fiat. And that's a common mistake, to think that God created the world out of nothing. I mean, you can't create something out of no thing. It's, it's not philosophically correct, is it?
No, not within our level of understanding or kind of reality spectrum, I guess. But it's same within in the Bible, when in the Romans, beginning of Romans, they're accused of worshipping creation rather than the creator. Kind of seems like a similar thing here.
Yeah, that's the point of it. And Savitri Devi, I mean, it's very strange that she really liked Akhenaten, because she was very anti-Christian. She was a little bit crazy. She saw Hitler as being an avatar of Vishnu. But she never actually made it to the Third Reich while it was in existence. It was only after the war that she went there, and she got involved with the former members of the SS and what have you. And she had quite an exalted position amongst National Socialists after the war. But sadly, she was very, very, very anti-Christian. I think it really did cloud her judgment in lots of ways. Yeah. But I think we'll leave that there for now. So thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more patriotic history for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.